Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of sustainability issues every week. It's brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. The regular panel of Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher have been joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene, politics, science and controversy on Sustainable Lens on Radio, tonight at 7 o'clock, and podcast on www.sustainablelens.org or www.oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. Tonight I'm coming to you from Wellington, where I'm at NIWA, the National Institute of Water and Atmospheric Research. I'm in the office of Dr. Andrew Tate, who is a principal scientist in the climate team. Thank you for having me. Andrew, you came to the public's attention last year with a nice quote where you said the climate had gotten stuck about the drought last year, and went on to explain the weather patterns and what was going on. What's the difference between the weather and the climate?
Well, Sam, the weather is what we experience every day. So fronts coming through with associated rainfall and winds, you know, the sort of thing that Wellingtonians know all too well about, the southerlies that come through or the nor'westers. So it's a day-by-day pattern of what we experience in terms of, you know, rainfall and temperature and wind and sunshine, for example. Whereas when we start to think about the climate, what we're really wanting to come to grips with is what we would expect for this time of year the temperatures to be, or how much rainfall we'd expect over this coming month or season or year. So it's more, there's actually a famous line, and I can't remember who to attribute it to, but it's the weather is what you get and the climate is what you expect. So you can think of it quite simply in those terms. Climate is much more of an average or an understanding of typical conditions. And by looking back in time, that's when, you know, looking at climate patterns over time becomes really interesting. How things have been changing, or are there cycles in the long-term record of some of these parameters like rainfall and temperature, for example?
In almost everybody's childhood, there was a golden summer, or endless golden summers. Mm. Is that some sort of rosy-tinted view of their summers, or was there golden summers that everybody grew up with?
Well, it's probably an element of what people tend to remember. Lots of people, when you're talking about drought, for example, will say, oh, well, you know, we used to have droughts this bad, you know, back in the day, you know, 40 years ago, I can remember droughts every year, sort of thing. But when you actually start to delve into the statistics, you find that, you know, the rarity of a particular event, you know, could be just as common now as it was in the past. So there is a little bit of, you know, rose-tintedness going on with people remembering back to the good old days. I think, you know, we've certainly seen some changes over time in our climate system, and we can talk about a bit about that later if you like, about, you know, what we've seen in terms of long-term trends in climate. But generally speaking, New Zealand is situated in a location where we have a lot of variability in our climate. And so we go from years where it's been warmer or drier almost instantly into years where it's wetter and cooler, and there's a great deal of this variability from year to year. Looking back at rainfall time series, for example, is just a really amazing to realise how much difference there can be from one year to another, and how New Zealanders, in particular people who are dependent on things like, on stuff like rainfall, farmers, for example, or you know, water security, water supply, infrastructure or asset managers, how they deal with that sort of level of variability is really impressive. So that's, I think, one of the truisms about New Zealand climate is that it varies a lot, and we do go from periods where we've had golden weather type situations to the worst summer we can ever remember pretty quickly, really.
Do we know what percentage of New Zealand's economy is dependent on climate?
I don't know, but it would be high because we have a pretty large percentage of our productivity associated with agriculture, energy and tourism, for example. And all of those things have got an element of weather and climate dependency. So I would think that weather and climate is particularly important for a lot of New Zealand's economy.
And they would want different things, wouldn't they? So what's golden for some would be not so golden for others.
Well, exactly right. With our hydroelectric industry, for example, they're obviously wanting to have a lot of rainfall to fill up their storage lakes. But that can have, downstream effects where if you've got, too much water in a river system, then that can cause problems downstream. So, yes, it's a question of, the particular uses, I suppose, of weather or water in particular, and how that, how different people, what their needs are, I suppose.
How did you get into studying the climate? Were you sitting looking at clouds as a small boy thinking, I need to understand that? Or?
No, not really. I had an interest in geography from school. I came from Southland. My roots are from Gore and Invercargill. And you can't get away from weather in Southland. And went to University of Otago, and I had no real idea about what I was going to be doing when I was at university, but I knew it was to do with science. And so I took quite a broad spectrum of courses, chemistry and physics and mathematics, and I kept geography on. And really at that stage, even in the first year, I was swayed a great deal by the professors in the geography department, who were just absolutely fantastic. And really, I think from that first year onwards, I was going to be a geographer. And I really do enjoy the climate or climatology part of geography. I'm a physical scientist more than a social scientist, and geography spans both of those fields. But I migrated more towards physical science and then in the end focusing in on climate science.
What was it that swayed you in the climate science direction?
I suppose interesting issues, interesting problems, learning from gathering and then analysing data, some global problems and global issues that even, in early 1990s, late 1980s when I started my university life, we were already starting to talk about issues of climate change, ozone depletion, things that really captivated me, I suppose, beyond just understanding a bit more about what New Zealand climate, what factors influence New Zealand's climate and how that really relates to what New Zealanders do. I think pretty quickly I was swayed by this climate field, and interesting stuff.
Can you remember the first time you heard the term climate change?
Well, I think it was back in those sort of early times at university, so late 80s, but research had been going on in climate change before that. So it's a long studied phenomena now. Still lots to learn, lots to know, but we're making strides, impressive strides these days. The computing power that goes into modelling global climate is absolutely phenomenal. And our understanding, our physical understanding of climatic systems is just going ahead leaps and bounds. And it has to, because this is a really amazing and worrisome and sometimes global issue that we need to get our heads around.
Did you do a master's?
I did. I started off doing a bachelor's in science with honours, and then my professor, Blair Fitzharris at the time, suggested that I transfer the honours onto a master's degree, so I went on and did a master's and had the honours associated with that. And then I again took his advice, and because he had done this, and a number of New Zealanders do this, and went overseas for a PhD. And I went to Boulder, Colorado, and it was just a fantastic place to go. And it's a hub at Boulder for atmospheric research. The National Center for Atmospheric Research is there, and others. The University of Colorado is known for its geography department. So what a great place to go for 4 years. And
they've had a bit of a weather event themselves.
Yeah, that's right. It wasn't anything like that when I was there, but boy, that was pretty impressive flooding.
And what did you do your PhD on?
I ended up going into the remote sensing field. So remote sensing is using satellite information for understanding terrestrial and atmospheric phenomena. And I was looking mostly at snow. So hydrology on a global scale, really. Particularly interested in trying to estimate the snow water equivalence in snowpacks, hemispheric snowpacks over the northern hemisphere, right over Eurasia and northern America. So the idea was, can we get a good feel for the amount of water that's contained in this snowpack, which obviously has implications for runoff, for the amount of, you know, how much water you can, what will come from those snowpacks when they melt. So that was the focus of my research, trying to estimate snow water equivalence using satellite data on the hemispheric scale. It was a little bit different because that sort of thing doesn't happen in New Zealand much. Our snowpacks are in very mountainous terrain, and it's very difficult to use remote sensing techniques in New Zealand. And we've got a very cloudy environment, which tends to impede a lot of the satellite sensors. Not all of them, but the visible wavelength ones in particular. So New Zealand remote sensing is much more in its infancy, whereas hemispheric, northern hemisphere remote sensing...
At a very different scale. Oh, working at from in New Zealand, I found it when I went on a similar sort of path, just the change in scale, it didn't matter what the local landscape was doing when we were working in the boreal ecosystem where it's dead flat for
exactly
thousands of miles.
Yeah. Oh, really? It's interesting stuff. And I got a really... I mean, it was lovely to work at the University of Colorado in Boulder. And then I was really fortunate also to get a postdoc a bit later on. I came back to New Zealand and went to UK, but then eventually ended up back in the United States at the Goddard Space Flight Center at NASA, just outside Washington, D.C., working as a contractor there. Again, back on this remote sensing issue, and I had 3 years there, so another really good time.
What were you working on?
Then it was a different satellite suite. It was this MODIS, what's called MODIS data, which is more in the infrared and visible spectrum, whereas my PhD had been primarily in the passive microwave, which is much longer wavelengths. So... it was really interesting to get back into that after a bit of time coming back to New Zealand and going to UK. But it was a phenomenal experience to be, you know, living and working in the States in that field. I don't do very much of it anymore, but I do try to keep on top of, you know, recent studies.
And then you came back here.
Yeah, I got a job offer from at NIWA in. I started in May of 2000. The interview was interesting because I was sitting in my office in Maryland and over the phone getting interviewed. But I've been at NIWA now, so that's 13 years or so. And it's been a fantastic place to work. A lot more diverse work goes on at NIWA in New Zealand. We tend to have multiple research streams going on at the same time. Everybody's got their finger in a number of pies. So whereas my American work was really focused on a particular project, now I'm all over the place, which is great. You know, such variety is awesome.
So what do they call you in to do? What are you the...
Oh, well,
what's Andrew the go-to guy for?
there's a relatively small climate team at NIWA. Around about 20 or so scientists out of a staff of 600 or so across the country. What I find absolutely intriguing then is that when you talk to anybody at a party or in the public about what NIWA does, they almost all say you are the climate guys. And you think, that's a very small percentage of people that are actually doing climate research compared with what else goes on at NIWA. NIWA is an incredibly broad organisation in terms of its research. And fisheries research is by far the most, in terms of the number of scientists.
But right.
You don't think of NIWA as the fisheries people.
No,
interesting. So climate is a small group, so we get all of us get involved in a lot of things. And I suppose where I've ended up focusing more than anything else is in the applications end. And so there's people that are doing more pure research modelling work, analysing data and producing results. But I'm much more interested in how that information is used.
Used in making the decisions by councils, by government.
Exactly. So there are multiple end users. It's phenomenal to try and map out that end user space. One of the largest end users is other researchers. So we work a lot, not only with people in NIWA, who are doing hydrology, so they need input into their hydrological models of rainfall and evapotranspiration and soil moisture, but freshwater ecology, which goes on in NIWA. There's a lot of coastal work, so there's a lot of wave modelling and erosion modelling, and there's air quality work, etc. So there's a lot of stuff that goes on in NIWA where the climate team have input. But we also work across the Crown Research Institutes and universities, and multiple projects we get into and get involved with. Particularly, climate change projects are obviously particularly of interest when NIWA has a strong involvement. But those projects may well be led by crop and food or ag research or land care or Victoria University, for example, and their focus perhaps of them is much more in terms of the impacts on farm productivity or hydrological impacts on low flows or flooding, or regional councils are particularly interested in extreme events, flooding, high rainfall events that can cause drainage problems, large sort of storm surge events that can cause erosion issues on coast, low rainfall periods, leading to drought and water supply issues. So there's, not only researchers, but the tendrils of climate information go really wide and into, a lot of people's business decisions.
I know it's kind of the nature of being a geographer, but do you have to know everything?
You kind of have to know a lot, yeah. And maybe you're right. The nature of a geographer is to know a little about a lot, and perhaps that's where I sit quite nicely. And it's great because you can have discussions and informed conversations with a farmer and then go and talk to a fisherman or go talk to a councillor or an engineer. And you can quickly get to the bones of what they need, what's important to them. And we can then get into a discussion about, we can probably do something along those lines. Or we're not there yet, or there's something we can do, but we can only present it in a form like a probability. Not a deterministic sort of value where you think, weather forecasting information is much more deterministic. We think we can say tomorrow we expect the temperature to be 25 degrees high, 14 degrees low, rain in the east. When you start to think about climate information and climate projections or climate outlooks for the season, you start to have to think about the chance of something happening being higher than average or lower than normal, lower than average or lower than normal, and putting, because the information is less certain, you have to put these uncertainty bounds around information as well. It makes using the information a challenge, and it makes communicating the information a challenge and quite interesting. You get into some very interesting conversations.
How much time do you spend explaining the principles of science?
To some degree, you do, depending on who you're talking to. More and more people are interested in how, for example, if you think about climate change, you can present information about what we expect the temperature to be like by the mid-century and by the end of the century based on projections, and then talk about the impacts of that on pasture production or what have you. And a lot of people just want to stay at that level. But others say, well, how are you making these projections? How is that information actually produced? And then you start to talk a little bit more about these global climate models. They're based on the physics of the air movement and moisture transport, and that they run on these huge supercomputers because we're producing basically what you would see in a weather forecast on the news, where you see a forecast that would say, it would show the progression of a frontal system over the country over the next 24 hours. That's a model output from a weather model. These global models are producing that for 100 years at different levels of the atmosphere and over the whole globe. And so it's an incredible conversation to start to get into if people are interested. And I think more and more people are.
When I'm introducing a group to concepts of sustainability, there's almost always somebody in the room who will say something like, this is all bunkum, there's sunspots on Mars, or there's ice on Mars, and that means that this doesn't make any sense at all. And what I can do is I can deflect that and say, yes, but if you swum in the nearest river recently, I can change the scale and make it sort of personal. But you probably have to deal with those. Someone's read somewhere that it's warmer on Mars than it used to be or something.
Yeah, there's a lot of misinformation around about particularly climate change, and that makes our job a challenge, but sometimes extremely frustrating. And I guess the way that information is conveyed these days very quickly and easily via media like, you know, Twitter and what have you, it's easy for a piece of some misinformation to be spread as if it were an equal in validity as a you know, some scientifically rigorous, well-founded information that's based on years and years of research and theory. And so, and I don't blame people for asking these questions, because there's this information glut on coming from both sides. I try, of course, to be as objective as I possibly can when I'm talking to people. And I say, look, my scientific training is that, you know, I want to look at all sides of an argument from an objective point of view. And if I can try to put that framing on it, that there's an objectivity needed rather than an emotional response based on information that may look like it's got some veracity but doesn't, but studying the source of that information in detail finds that it's got no grounding at all. So we do get into some interesting conversations with people who have heard something or read something, or somebody passed some information on to them that the world has been this warm before, so what are you talking about? It's not nothing to do with us. And that's, a lot of people accept the fact that, you know, maybe your temperature records show that we've been warming, but it can't have anything to do with humans. Look how big the globe is and how much climate there is. Atmosphere around that globe, and look how many, you know, how can humans have that influence on such a huge system as that? Through really the emissions of a gas, carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, in extremely small quantities.
But lots and lots of times.
But lots of times and over a long period. And so it's an interesting question to get into with people, and I just try to be as objective as I possibly can and talk about facts. And of course, these days, there's more and more evidence as well. And so you can be objective in terms of fact and theory, but now it's also possible to show evidence that can't be explained any other way other than an anthropogenic influence on our climate, a man-made influence on our climate. And there are things like, you know, the carbon concentration in the atmosphere, carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere is going up, and we can actually look at the human fingerprint of those carbon atoms or carbon ions and see that they were produced through burning. So there is actual, you know, really tangible evidence that humans are having an influence on our atmospheric composition. And then there's evidence that that is also having an influence on our climate and on our ice sheets and on our weather patterns. So more and more I'm trying to be a bit more of a scientific explanation to the whole thing.
The objectivity that you're talking about is scientific scepticism. It's kind of unfortunate that climate sceptics have managed to muddy that term.
Yeah, science is all about being sceptical. You can't go forward unless you're asking questions of things. And you're right, it is a term that's been muddied. And I appreciate people asking questions so that we can get into a discussion and can show our side of that discussion based on evidence and based on scientific theory and fact. What really frustrates me a great deal is when people will just simply not accept it, won't even open their minds to it. And one of the terms that's talked about, you know, is denialism. And that's just, I mean, that's beyond what a scientist can really handle when you're up against someone who will not open themselves to even be informed. They've got a worldview that if your information doesn't fit that worldview, then they're just closed to it. So with climate change, because it's global, because it has some serious implications, and because there's a man-made cause, just invokes these emotions in people that that lead to some of this denialism, and that's really hard to overcome.
I find that study, I can't remember where it was, the one that said that the level of scientific education doesn't affect your belief in climate change as much as your political allegiance. And it just seems, presumably it was an American study.
Probably American, yeah. I mean, I think you're right. I think that does come from a study looking at Republicans and Democrats. And it's become a political issue in the States, for sure.
And in Australia.
Exactly, that's right. And all over the world. But particularly, I think, in America, because if you're a Republican now, you don't believe in climate change. It's almost one of those at that level, which is alarming, really.
Perhaps science doesn't help itself, in that every time that there is a cold snap in the summer, Twitter is full of what happened to climate change type comments. And the scientists are reluctant to say this storm is because of climate change or this particular event is because of climate change. But it's sort of like that reluctance gets in the way.
Mm. Well, that's just because scientists need rigor. And you can't say those things rigorously because there's so much inherent variability in the system. I mean, think about what I said about New Zealand's climate. It's so variable. And we're trying to pick a trend or a pattern in that over a long-term period, and you can start to see that in the temperature. But things like storm events, there's still so much variability in the system that you can't attribute a particular climate.
So you can't say this particular storm is because of climate change, no. But the fact that we've had four in the last 5 years?
Exactly.
That's
where we're starting to see much more emphasis on the frequency and intensity of these events, which because of the nature of a warming planet, we expect to have more intense and frequent storms. And that is something that you can start to point to. In fact, there's some really, really interesting research now that's still in its infancy, probably in the last 5 years really been coming to the fore, and that's this detection and attribution work. So detecting, for example, something coming out of the noise of climate variability, a big storm system or a heat wave, and attributing to how much of that can you attribute to a forcing that's related to a climate change signal. And there's more and more of this detection and attribution work now going on, and I think that we still need to have more time to gather more data to see this, and as time goes on we'll also see it become more clearly outside the noise level because of the influences of global warming. To be able to attribute a particular storm to climate change, I don't think is ever going to happen. We can start to talk about the statistics of these storms, their frequency, their intensity over time changing. And that's just the way it is. And so the question is wrong. You can't ask that question because you're always going to get the same answer, which is unsatisfactory.
Do we know that the frequency and intensity is getting worse, or is it that the human infrastructure is more vulnerable in more vulnerable places and it's getting reported more? How do you unravel those?
The hard to unravel, yeah. There's certainly signals coming through in other places of the world in the climate record that are showing the frequency and intensity of storms is changing over time. In New Zealand, we haven't got that clear signal. And it's one of these situations where our climate record is relatively short, only about 100 years, and our variability is large, and so it's going to be hard to find these signals in a New Zealand record. But in more continental locations and larger areas, they're starting to pick out these signals now. It's still early days for a lot of places around the world, but I think we are starting to see some of these effects.
How confident are you in that climate record? We hear about things like there's a heat island and this one's been moved from this botanic gardens to here and it's not the same... Is that accounted for, or are you confident about that?
As you go back in time, you get fewer and fewer recording sites. So going back to the 100 years, and we've only got about 10 or 20-odd places in the country that were actually recording data in the first place. But those sites were set up really with a knowledge base from European settlers that you had to put these recording sites in places that were not going to be influenced were as influenced as low as possible from human activities. So they tended to be outside of urban areas, and as urban areas have built up, if those sites have started to become overrun from urban areas, then they'd have to be moved. Airports, for example, are a good site because there's a lot of open space and away from influences like buildings and trees, for example. So most of the sighting is actually really important, and that gives us confidence going back in time that we've had records that are still representative of the general climate and not of other things that are influencing it, like having a climate station in downtown Auckland, for example, in the built-up environment. There's still work that goes on to what we call homogenise these long-term records to make sure that we are not if we see a trend in it, we want to make sure that it's a climatic trend and not something like an urbanisation effect. So there's work that goes on to homogenise long data records. And like I said, if stations had to be changed for one location for one reason or another, then it's very, very important to see what that change has, how that change has affected that temperature or whatever record of data. You can't just go willy-nilly just taking a set of data that was recorded up in Kelvin, up at 100 metres above sea level, and then just tacking it on to the record that started at the Wellington Airport and saying that's a continuous record without trying to understand the change caused by that sighting change. And that's a lot of work goes on to that in that homogenization space.
Do you spend your life swimming around in these numbers? And I'm just trying to understand the work life of a climate scientist. Is it spreadsheets galore, or how does it work?
Yeah, there's a lot of number work. All of us are pretty adept at programming, so there's a lot of number crunching. We have spreadsheets, but other programming systems are used a lot. There are big data sets, particularly when you're talking the remote sensing space, when you're talking about satellite data sets, which we use a lot around here in NIWA as well, particularly with our weather forecasting research. So you've got to be pretty adept at dealing with large amounts of data. I kind of do sort of swim around in numbers. But my goal, I suppose, and this is where I said I'd sort of start, I now sort of focus more on the applications end, is to present those numbers in ways that they can be easily digested by a great number of people. And we have a fantastic database of numbers, and we make that database freely accessible to anybody who wants to pull out the rainfall record at Upper Hutt for the last 30 years. And that's maybe all they want to know. They want to get those daily values, and they want to put it in a spreadsheet, and they want to look at it. But a lot of people would find that difficult. Not just getting the data and putting in a spreadsheet, but then understanding what it means. So there's a lot of work at the applications end, which I tend to be at, of producing visualizations of that data. They're much more easily understood and, for example, you know, plots or maps. Maps are fantastic. So we do a lot of work with mapping, and we use some software, GIS software, Geographic Information Systems. So a lot of interpolating the values that are recorded at specific locations around the country and estimating what those values are in between the recording locations using an interpolation method. So you can produce a map of the whole country or a map of Southland or a map of Wellington City.
I can sort of see how you go up in the scale from the local observations into the climate models and work out what's going to happen on the large scale. How do you get back down to the local? Is it just straight the reverse?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of ways. So there's you can take actual observations from around the country. You know, what the rainfall that was measured yesterday in Timaru and Ashburton and Christchurch Airport, and throughout the country, we've got from automatic climate stations that don't require any human intervention, there's about 150 around the country. Plus there's also another about 350 to 400 manual sites that where people are actually taking rainfall measurements every day. So there's a lot of that data, and we can go to this sort of more intermediary scale from those point measurements directly through this interpolation, if you like. So filling in the gaps between the measurement sites to tell us, well, if we know what it rainfall was in Timaru and Ashburton, then what we can estimate what it was all the way between those two places. And then you can fill in the whole space aerially wise by doing these interpolation schemes and making a map of all of New Zealand. Now, that, like you said, that data source at the point locations is also really useful and integral to producing models at a larger scale of the weather systems that are coming over the country. And those weather system models might be at scales of, you know, 10 kilometres to 20 kilometres per value, per estimated parameter. And a lot of people say, well, I need to know much more detail than that, so we can scale back from that scale down to the local as well, using mostly statistical methods. So there's a lot goes on from both sort of ends of the spectrum.
And you need to do that over time. People want to know if they're building a bridge or planting grapes, they need to know what the climate's going to be doing in 20, 30 years.
Yeah, they'd like to know, first of all, what the climate has done So climatology, the science of climate, it's climate science, if you like, is mostly about understanding what our climate is like and how it's changed over time. And that's where we've got our strength, because it's based on observations. But then again, you're right, people do also want to have an understanding of what the climate may do. Will it change? Will it vary on a seasonal basis? What's this coming summer going to be like? Is it going to be another beautiful summer like we had last year? Or is it going to be a rotten summer like we had the one before? And that really does affect people around the country, not just because they want to go to the beach or have a barbecue, but also what's the timing of the ripening of the fruit on their trees, or their vines? Or how much pasture are they going to have in the field at any one time in the coming summer, autumn period, so that they can, you know, schedule their farming activities around those predictions. So it's all about, yeah, learning from the past and trying to give our best estimation of what we think is coming. And then in the long term also, for strategic thinking. And like, you know, is this piece of land in Canterbury where we're doing intensive dairying and we can only do it because we've got massive amount of irrigation? Are we still going to be able to do that in 2050? Or if we're going to really struggle because we've got a likely change in the water supply to that location through not just through streams and rivers, but maybe groundwater as well, and that may be related to a change of the weather patterns over time, which we're predicting in these global models. What could they potentially do now or in the next 10 years to reduce their vulnerability to those sort of long-term changes? You know, infrastructure investment, or should you be thinking about retiring land, or diversifying? So there's a lot of strategic thinking that can be made if we can give them, you know, useful guidance about how we think things are going to change long term as well.
But people don't want to hear that.
They want to know that they can keep doing what they're doing.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it comes to the the crux of what you're interested in, and that's sustainability. You don't want to be doing what you're doing if it's not sustainable. And I think everybody in New Zealand is interested, who's particularly in the agricultural sector, but in just about everything you do, you'd find people that have the principles of sustainability embedded in their decision logic. And so climate information is part of the landscape of being able to do what you do sustainably and continue to have this piece of land productive for many, many generations to come, not just the next year. I think actually it's really interesting the way that New Zealanders, particularly if I talk about farmers for a start, have reacted to last year's drought. You know, we led into this sort of thing talking about drought. We had a massive drought on our hands last year. The North Island was as dry as a bone. And even parts of the South Island, west coast of the South Island, which you would just never think they could be in drought, but they did. They had a really drought issue in the west coast. But North Island in particular, and from about October 2012, it started drying up really significantly. And you expect to have drying coming into the summer. The soils tend to, dry up, not as much moisture held in the soil. But it was well below what it would normally be at that stage, and it just continued to get worse and worse throughout November, December. And then January and February and March were some of the driest months we've had on record for some places. The rainfall amounts were in the order of, less than 10 millimetres over a month for places like Tauranga and others. Just phenomenally low numbers. And the soils basically dried out, and it was so widespread. We have a lot of droughts in New Zealand. Pretty much every year somebody's drier than what they normally would be. But we have a lot of adaptability as well around our farming systems so that people can move stock or get in feed or things like that. And water storage, etc., is an important element of that, you know, being more resilient to these climatic fluctuations. But when you get a big event like this, which was covered the whole North Island, it becomes really a real challenge. But I found it really inspiring the way that New Zealand farmers were able to manage this drought, even on this sort of larger scale. And to me, that's a change in thinking. Maybe it's, you know, certain people, maybe they were always thought along these ways of being well prepared for adversity, or have strategies in place when they start to see things going along a particular path. Sell animals quickly, you know, don't hold on to stock. Get your feed budgets sorted out, get your feed contracts sorted out early, you know, for importing palm kernel or other feed from off farm. Talking to your bank manager early, you know. I think from this last drought we saw a bit of a change in mindset in the farming community in New Zealand. It's been coming for a long time, I think, but we're becoming much better at dealing with adverse situations.
But you seem to be having more of them.
Like I said, I think some place in New Zealand typically will be dry, if not every year, then every other year. Some places get it more frequently than others. And I think of places like Hawke's Bay, Gisborne, Wairarapa type areas that have in the past had drought upon drought upon drought. And the ability for people there, living off the land, particularly sheep and beef farmers, for example, will get strained more and more if they keep coming. You know, if these events keep coming every year, there's a limit. So places tend to get dry around the country, but this was a big event that happened, you know, over a large area, and that put a lot of strain on resources. But I think, you know, coming through it, we did pretty well as a nation. We were fortunate that come about April this year, I think you used my quote that the climate pattern got stuck over that drought period. We had a lot of high pressure systems, anticyclones covering the country, and they tended just to stick around these lovely days, but no moisture. It became unstuck in almost overnight in April, and we went back into a much more of a dynamic weather patterns coming over the country with frontal systems and low pressure systems giving us plenty of rain. So we went into April, May, and so autumn was a stark relief to this dry situation we had over summer and start of autumn. And then winter was particularly good. We had a warm winter. We had one of the warmest winters on record for a lot of places around the country. So we had warmth and moisture, and there's just nothing else you want if you're a farmer. You want warmth and moisture, and your grass will grow. Mm-hmm. And so we've been very fortunate coming out of a very dire drought to have a positive type climate for the autumn and winter, and even the start of the spring has been really warm and good for growth. I do think that, you know, farmers made their way through that drought really surprisingly well.
It seems to me that your job in terms of the predictability of the climate is getting harder, although the tools are getting better. But it's almost getting easier in the communication because people are starting to accept the variability.
I think it comes down to people understanding how to use information or wanting information. And the information is there, and we're trying to provide it in the most useful format we possibly can. But there's got to be a desire to want it and to use it, to need it and use it. And I think that desire is there now. I think people are taking data from all over the place and really incorporating it in their decision-making systems. And when we're trying to be on board with that and understand a little bit, you know, as much as we can, what data they want, how frequently they need it.
Do you try and make a point of staying out of the political?
Oh, for sure, yeah.
I'm thinking about James Hansen or Bill McKibben's publicising the however part per million it is that's deemed to be safe. And that safe is a very politically charged term.
Mm.
Can you be objective about a term like safe, or do you have to be objective about? Is that pushing the objectivity too far?
To me, it's going beyond what a scientist should be doing. But this is, I think, there's a frustration for being a scientist who only wants to provide information, best information you possibly can for a decision maker to use, and seeing that that information isn't being used well. There's a big frustration there. And so I can understand why others, particularly if they've got a global soapbox, will have got into this debate about why isn't more being done. From my perspective, I'm not prepared to get into that. Into that area. I want to help as much as I possibly can. And I don't just, I mean, at NIWA, across the board actually, in research organisations in New Zealand, we're such a small community of scientists that we do get involved in discussions with policymakers at all levels. And we can be at that personal level of talking to a minister or a CEO. But they don't want us to be telling them what to do. And I don't think anybody really wants somebody who's, you know, come from an ivory tower telling them what to do. But I think people appreciate the effort that you make to try to connect with them, to say, if you want to be making the best decisions you possibly can, then please take account of this information and understand how it was derived and what its implications are. And the scientists can do a lot to make that bridge.
Do you find yourself in public discussions with politicians that say this is all bunkum? How do you avoid, or how do you stick to the science and not go over that line?
I haven't even found myself in that situation. I think New Zealanders typically appreciate when a scientist or someone who's got some knowledge that will hopefully be of interest comes and talks to them and gives them their interpretation of information to try, in particular, to help them better understand a situation. And I haven't ever been in that situation where somebody is just completely rubbishing you in public. I think it does happen around the world a bit more. There are people in New Zealand that have got a reasonably sceptical point of view with climate change. And we have in the past, or some of my colleagues, not me in person, but some of my colleagues have gone into a sort of a debate-type arena with them. These are the folks, I would say, you're never going to change their perspective on things. And so those debates tend to be rather unfruitful. And we'd much rather spend our efforts and, you know, limited resources talking to people that want to hear us. So I think that's probably the situation.
One of the things that we usually ask on the show is asking people if they're an activist. And I think I'll ask it. Are you an activist?
Well, no, what's the definition of an activist?
Yeah. Well, that's kind of the interesting point in that, you know,
I'm active in that
passionate about it?
Oh, well, yes. And I'm active in that I'm happy to be involved in discussions. And I am passionate about the issues. And passionate about conveying the science through so that people can understand it and use it and make better decisions from it.
If someone was making a clearly terrible decision, would you come out and say, that's really not a good idea, and this is why?
I'd hesitate to do that, but I'd I'd welcome the chance to talk to the person to if they were they'd invite me to their office to talk about how they make decisions. Were they aware of information that might help make decisions that are perhaps a bit more long term and strategic, and not lead to perverse actions or outcomes. So I'd be happy enough at that stage to be involved in a conversation, but I don't think I would jump up and
I suppose it's the importance of the communication, the visualizations and so on that you've been talking about, is communicating it as clearly and simply as possible.
Yeah, I agree, and it's providing mechanisms as well, because one of the projects I was involved in, which was really cool, was building what we called an urban impacts toolbox, climate change and urban impacts toolbox. And there was a need there. It was funded through the government, and there was a perceived need that urban environments, in particular our councils, who are working hard to make sure that people in New Zealand who are living in their cities have the infrastructure that's needed, they're kept safe from hazards, that have the supply of essentials, that those folks may need more tools to understand the implications of climate change on the business that they do. And I'm talking mostly about folks like engineers, asset managers, hazard analysts, planners. So we built, it was a 4-year project, and I worked really closely with an engineering consultancy who was absolutely fantastic working with. And we built a suite of analysis tools, if you like, that a council staff could use to better understand the likelihood of flood frequency changing in the future, or water security changing in the future, or the number of storm events causing big rainfall deluges which would clog up their drainage networks and cause localized flooding. Is that likely to change to be more potent or more frequent in the future? So there's a lot of these analysis tools that were already to hand, but perhaps disparate and not well connected. We tried to build up this toolbox of these mechanisms for doing analysis. And what I'd really like to see now, that came to fruition about a year ago, and we had some really great buy-in at council level developing what these tools would be, how they could be structured and organised in the toolbox. What I'd really like to see now is to actually start working with councils. Some of them are already, but I think there's a great need now to use these tools.
The challenge for the councils in that some people see that the council's primary role is to protect the property values, and knowing that kind of information might not be helping that. It's not, if you're having to say, we're going to have to walk away from the suburb, that's a massive decision for a council, isn't it?
It's huge and extremely political and causes all sorts of reaction from residents and others involved. And it's already, you're already seeing it. Now, there's a couple of classics. There's up the Kapiti Coast, for example, in terms of people who are living close to the coast, who are already being and have always been impacted by erosion. What might happen with sea level rise on those erosion rates? Boy, it invokes some really interesting and heated discussions amongst people who are concerned about their properties and the future value of those properties. It's coming more and more. We're going to see it more and more. But you've got to sort of ask ourselves the question, would we be better off if we didn't know or didn't attempt to know what some of these future changes might be? just because they may have some significant implications for where people live. I mean, you said, you know, it's, you know, people's value, property value is important, but so is protecting their lives. I'd much rather know what the flood risk of the, I live in the Hutt Valley, you know, what's the flood risk in that massively urbanised floodplain? You know, is that going to change over time? And if it is, then how might we best be protected from that, flood banks and other systems to try to, you know, alleviate that risk? Information's got to be useful, surely, to be able to, you know, do make the best decisions about how the land is used and where people live.
Are we producing enough people that can think like that? Maybe just thinking geographers. Are we thinking are councils and ministries and things got enough people that are able to be taking that information in and doing the right stuff with it?
Yeah, I think so. There's got to be some strategic push for people to actually start doing the work and producing these reports and seriously thinking about their implications. And I think there's a hesitancy to do that, to start doing that work, because of the perceived implications of, you know, what the results might show. And that comes down to, you know, the reaction you might get, for example, like, just like what you're saying, you know, people's properties values may be affected. So I think the people and structures are in place, but there's got to be a desire to do it. And sometimes in the political climate, there's not that desire because of perceived implications of what that information might mean.
Are we getting it right at school, do you think? Not, I don't know, is climatology there at all? But perhaps it's more about a scientific way of thinking.
I don't really know. We've got some really, really great graduates coming through our universities. And, you know, we're always on the lookout for talented scientists. And they don't necessarily have to be a climate scientist, someone who thinks, you know, logically, and can apply methodologies and rigor, can be a climate scientist just as easily as they can be a chemist.
And in your case, make those connections between that science, if you like, and the what you described as the applications, the
people
doing something with it. Is that the bridge that we need more of?
I think it's getting more and more of that. Because that's where the interest, I think, a lot of the interest lies. Although I am more of an applied scientist than a pure scientist. It's great to produce some new scientific results, and I love to see that sort of stuff coming through. And I do a little bit of it on the side, and publish papers every now and then, and that's always good. But it's how that information is used, and can it influence somebody, and can it open people's eyes to possibilities? I love that end. Yeah. So that's, and I think there's more and more of that work going on these days. More and more people in that part of the science communication delivery, field, which is not just climate; it's all sorts.
Lastly, what are the challenges for you for the next couple of years?
I think continuing on. There's still, you know, a lot of a big challenge in communicating information, communicating science. New science results coming out all the time. Climate change science is just pushing ahead fast. The amount of data that's coming out, the representation of that information so that it makes sense is really critical. So that's a big challenge for me. A big project that I'm involved in right now is moving toward integrated analysis and integrated systems analysis. So saying, okay, well, let's say we've got a warmer climate and that might influence the rainfall regime in the Bay of Plenty and therefore on the flow that we'd see in certain catchments. How is that affecting sedimentation rates? How are those sedimentation rates also being affected by land use change? And is the climate influencing the land use change as well? What is the quality of that water? Are we seeing a deterioration in the quality of that water? What happens when the water flows out into the Bay of Plenty and deposits this sediment? What's happening to the coastal environment? And how is sea level rise interacting with that at the same time? So and then the people that are living in that environment. What are the social conditions, socioeconomic conditions of people in towns and cities that are implicated or affected by some of these things that are going, these physical processes that are ongoing, and how they interact with those, the changes that might come from diminished quality of water through then flowing through into fish species, and how that might impact on Kaimoana collection and what have you, is really, really interesting. The economics of productivity around land use and its relationship with regulation coming from a council on nitrogen leaching. All of this physical, biological, social, economic landscape that goes on, there's a lot of interaction there. So big project to try to better understand all these linkages.
And then communicate it.
Oh, for sure. Well, people are actually, because they're part of the system, they have to be in the research. And I tell you, there's no better way to communicate research than having people involved in it. Because there's so much, there's so much more buy-in and ownership of the information. So you don't just turn up somewhere, do a study for 3 or 4 years, and then come along to a town meeting and present it all. That model of science is gone. You got to have those people involved in the data collection and the understanding and the interaction with the scientists all the way through the project. And they're telling you, oh, that's all very good, but actually what I really want to know is this. And scientists go, oh, all right, hang on. We've got to think about this completely different. And that's where you get value, and that's fantastic. So there's a big challenge in that. But the reward to come out of that sort of multidisciplinary and integrated assessment type work is, just phenomenal. You start to understand actual interactions and processes. So yeah, that's pretty much where I'll be, and that'll be me for the next few years for sure, and ongoing.
Cool. Thank you very much. You've been listening to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. Tonight's guest was Dr. Andrew Tate, a climate scientist and communicator of science from Niwa in Wellington, was sitting in his office. We broadcast on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz, and podcast on sustainablelens.org. You can follow the links there to find us on Facebook. And you can find us on iTunes as well. I'm Samuel Mann. I hope you enjoyed the show.
Sustainable Lens on Radio.